Krishna has returned to Dwarka. In text 25 of the 11th chapter, we heard how the inhabitants of Dwarka were regularly accustomed to look upon the reservoir of all beauty. What does that mean, the reservoir of all beauty? It's a reservoir. All beauty. So Krishna possesses an ocean of beauty. If one considers that ocean the source of all things that are beautiful within this material world. So something within this material world has beauty, like a drop, like we may take a drop from the ocean. But Krishna's beauty is compared again to an ocean, the reservoir or source of all beauty. So they were used to looking at him every day, the reservoir of all beauty, the infallible Lord. And by looking at him, they were never satiated. What does satiated mean? Satisfied, but not quite satisfied. Filled, like, I've had enough. Okay, thank you. It was good, but I had enough. Yes, saturated, like that. Okay, it was wonderful, but now is enough. So, no matter how good the cooking is, but there is a limit to how much we can eat before we get satiated. But when it comes to looking at Krishna, there is no satiation point for the soul. Because Krishna, again, is an ocean, more than an unlimited, anandam bhudivaradhanam, an ever-increasing, unlimited ocean of beauty. So they never felt satisfied. Satisfied in the sense of, okay, I've seen Krishna, what's next? No, not like that. Never, never, never. Text 26. The Lord's chest is the abode of the goddess of fortune. His moon-like face is the drinking vessel for eyes which hanker after all that is beautiful. So a drinking vessel is something that a drink is contained within. So within the moon-like face of Krishna, that is the vessel. It is the vessel for eyes which hanker after all that is beautiful. So anyone who wishes to see that ocean of beauty, of all beauty, should look at this, at the wonderful face of Krishna, which is compared to a moon. His arms, and interesting how the eyes are for seeing, the tongue is for drinking. But in this case, the eyes, when looking at Krishna, practically turn into tongues and lick up the beauty of Krishna from his moon-like face. His arms are the resting place for the administrative demigods, very powerful, and his lotus feet are the refuge of pure devotees who never talk or sing of any subject except his lordship. Why? Why are they like that? Why are pure devotees like that? Yes. Yes. Because they love Krishna. But not only do they love him, he is the natural object of all love. And he has unlimited qualities that they could continue talking about forever and ever and ever. And they are immersed in the sweetness of discussing Krishna, and thereby they are satisfied but never satiated. They are satisfied in the sense that they never feel the need to go anywhere else. We'll read from Prabhupada's purport, the second half on the following page. The essence of everything is the Supreme Lord. He is called Saram. Saram means the sar, or the essence. And those who sing, just like cream is called the sar of milk. It's the essence of the milk. And those who sing about him are called the sarangas, or the pure devotees. The pure devotees are always hankering after the lotus feet of the Lord. The lotus has a kind of honey, which is transcendentally relished by the devotees. They are like the bees who are always after the honey of the Lord's lotus feet. Because everything is being described here poetically, metaphorically, because it's hard to say, describe directly how beautiful Krishna's face is without comparing it to that which is beautiful in this world. How tasty the sweetness of Krishna's lotus feet are. Because when we think of feet, we don't think of something that's tasty and sweet. So we have to compare it to something in the material world that we know is wonderful and sweet. So it's like honey. And the devotees are mad after the honey of the Lord's lotus feet, just like bees are mad after the honey coming from a lotus flower. Srila Rupa Goswami, the great devotee acharya of the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya, has sung a song about this lotus honey, comparing himself to the bee. O my Lord Krishna, I beg to offer my prayers unto you. My mind is like the bee, and it is after some honey. Kindly, therefore, give my bee mind a place at your lotus feet, which are the resources for all transcendental honey. I know that even big demigods like Brahma do not see the rays of the nails of your lotus feet, even though they're engaged in deep meditation for years together. Still, O infallible one, my ambition is such, for you are very merciful to your bees. O Madhava, I know that I have no genuine devotion for the service of your lotus feet, but because your lordship is inconceivably powerful, you can do what is impossible to be done. Your lotus feet can deride even the nectar of the heavenly kingdom, and therefore I am very much attracted by them. O Supreme Eternal, please, therefore, let my mind be fixed at your lotus feet so that eternally I may be able to relish a taste of your transcendental. The devotees are satisfied with being placed at the lotus feet of the Lord and have no ambition to see his all-beautiful face or aspire for the protection of the strong arms of the Lord. They are humble by nature, and the Lord is always leaning towards humble devotees. Who can say something about those last few lines that Prabhupada wrote? What is the meaning of that? Yes. So where is the point about service? Where is the point in there about service? Where does it come up? Yeah, but after that. The devotees are satisfied with being placed at the lotus feet of the Lord. That's really what it means to be placed at the lotus feet of the Lord. It means to be engaged in his service. Thank you. Good comment. Any other comments on that? On this? Just see the mood of a devotee. Rupa Goswami is revealing it. Yes. It was fanning, I think. Fanning the Lord directly. Who is that? Dharuka. Krishna's chariot driver who is in Dasyaras. So he didn't want his own ecstasy even to get in the way of service. So the heart of Krishna consciousness or even Goloka Vrindavan is service. It's service. So all the devotees want to please Krishna there. Everyone there wants to please Krishna. Mother Yasoda may be chastising Krishna, but her only desire is to serve and please Krishna. And that is the center of the spiritual world. Therefore, it is completely harmonious because everyone only wants to please Krishna. And that also explains why I can't get there, because I want to go to Vrindavan, the spiritual world, but why? Because it will be so great, I would make a good slideshow and I can come back and tell all the devotees about it. I've been to Vrindavan like that, and it's so wonderful. Because the essence, again, is full loving service. And unless our full loving serving mood is developed to the highest point, we can't actually go there. And this is very important to understand, that the essence of what it takes to relate to Krishna, to be with Krishna, is loving service. Now, why is this so important to understand? That will come up later in this chapter. And we'll see how Krishna relates to those devotees whose serving mood and loving mood is developed to the fullest extent. How will Krishna deal with that? Is he some type of a lord who's on a throne? And so, because Krishna has millions and millions and billions, unlimited servitors. So does he just ordering, okay, you do this, now you do this, okay, you do this, you do this, you do this. And he's there on his throne with his big beard and his crown and his scepter. I am the king, I am the lord, I'm the all-powerful. And if you don't do what I say, the thunderbolt is coming very quickly. Be careful. How does Krishna deal with these people like Rupa Goswami? No, don't tell us the answer now. We're trying to build up some real suspense here. How will Krishna reciprocate? Actually, In the 10th canto, when the gopis come to him, he says, I can't reciprocate. Just like when Krishna went to Sudama Vipra, or Sudama Vipra went to Krishna, and he gave him this what? What did he give him? Some chipped rice. Now, where did he get this chipped rice from? From the neighbors. He begged it from the neighbors. Now, why did he beg it from the neighbors? Do you know? Because he didn't have anything in his house. He was so poor. And Krishna, after Sudama came and left, Krishna didn't tell him that he was going to give him any benediction. And when Sudama got back, he saw that he had unlimited opulence. Why didn't Krishna tell him? Because Krishna was very shy and embarrassed. Because one should reciprocate with an equal gift, with a gift equally. And Sudama had given him this chipped rice. So on one level it was chipped rice. But on another level, it was more than he had. Because he had to beg for it. So he gave Krishna more than he had with devotion. And then Krishna thought, how am I going to reciprocate with this? Everything is mine and nothing is outside of being mine. So I can't give him more than I have because there is nothing more than what I have. So I can only give him some token. So Krishna was very embarrassed. So Krishna becomes sometimes defeated by the devotion of his devotees when it is pure. And this is what it takes, actually, to go to Goloka Vrindavan. To have such overwhelming, because we say the term pure devotion, unalloyed devotion, but what that means is an overwhelming unalloyed means no tinges of anything else. But overwhelming loving desire to please Krishna. And this is what these residents of Dwarka possessed. So as Krishna passed along the public road, this is 27, of Dwarka, his head was protected from the sunshine by a white umbrella. White feathered fans moved in semicircles, and showers of flowers fell upon the road. His yellow garments and garlands of flowers made it appear as if a dark cloud was surrounded simultaneously by the sun, moon, lightning, and rainbows. So to describe the beauty of the scene of Krishna entering into Dwarka, the description by whom? Who is describing this? Tutsa Goswami. He's become very poetic and describing phenomenon, natural phenomenon that cannot simultaneously take place. The sun, the moon, lightning and rainbows, they don't happen at the same time. But to give some us idea of this incredible beauty of this scene, he's used these comparisons. So now Krishna has greeted all the residents of Dwarka, not all the residents, but so many of the residents of Dwarka. Now he's going to move to the intimate, most intimate ones. So first, he enters the house of his father. He was embraced by the mothers present, and the Lord offered his obeisances unto them by placing his head at their feet. I used to watch this when I lived in Hong Kong many years ago and before I had ever been to India. I used to watch I'd be at the airport, and the Indian ladies, Matajis, would be returning from India on a airplane flight, and I'd watch their sons greet them by coming and touching their feet like that. And I was always, "Do you touch your mother's feet?" Like that. Was that from generations ago? You? But it's very, very endearing, and naturally the parents' hearts melt, and they just want to give them everything, bless them in every way. So that's culture. So Krishna set this incredible example. This is God. Again, the supreme controller, the cause of all causes, universes emanating from the pores of his skin. And he's bowing down and touching his mother's feet. And what are the mothers doing? The mothers, after embracing their son, they sat him on their laps. Due to pure affection, milk sprang from their breasts. They were overwhelmed with delight, and the tears from their eyes wetted the Lord. So much affection from all the mothers, all the wives of Devaki, of Vasudev. Then, now it will get still more intimate. Thereafter, the Lord entered his palaces, which were perfect to the fullest extent. What an expression. Perfect to the fullest extent. As much as anything can be perfect, the palaces were perfect. They had no imperfections. Look at anything in this material world, anything, pick anything, and you look at it closely enough, you will find imperfections in it. That's why it's hard to live with somebody. Because after a while, all you start seeing is the imperfections, because imperfections are there in everything, in everyone. But these palaces had no imperfections. They were flawless. His wives lived in them, and they numbered over 16,000. Now, we'll talk a little more about this. By reading something, but I just want to read a little bit from the purport to the following verse, and we haven't read that verse yet. This is the text 31, about halfway through, a little less than halfway through. The queens were also expansions of his internal potency. And thus the potent and potencies are perpetually exchanging transcendental pleasure, known as the pastimes of the Lord. So this is really the secret of what's going on. That Krishna is exchanging past energy, exchanging pleasure with his different energies. And even when the jivas go attain the spiritual world, it's not just them who's exchanging pastimes with the Lord, because it's them who has taken shelter of the internal energy, Ladini Sambit. Because otherwise, how could one teeny jiva give the Lord any pleasure? No, this is actually done in conjunction with the internal energy, Ladini Shakti. So that's what the pastimes of the Lord are. It's not that Krishna is lacking anything, he's just exchanging love with his different energies and potencies. So it's all within Krishna. And this coming now is the specific point I wanted to read that Prabhupada makes. One should not, therefore, become astonished to learn that the Lord married so many wives. Of course, the devotees don't become astonished by this. How many wives? 16,108. On the contrary, one should affirm that even if the Lord married 16,000 million wives, he is not completely manifesting his unlimited and exhaustible potency. He married only 16,000 wives and entered into each and every one of the different palaces just to impress in the history of the human beings on the surface of the earth that the Lord is never equal to or less than any human being, however powerful he may be. No one, therefore, is either equal to or greater than the Lord. And what is the name of the Lord? Asama Udva. So Udva means greater than, and Sama means equal to. So, and the means not. So not greater than, not equal to, Asama and Udva, or great. This is a definition of God. The Lord is always great in all respects. God is great is eternal truth. So where does God is great come from, that expression? Huh? Yes. Allah Akbar. That's really God is Akbar, one. But how great God is, as soon as you want to get into details, well, God is great. Okay, in what way is he great? Well, he created the universe. Does he do anything more than that? Yes, he's the reservoir of beauty. The source of all beauty. So that means a person. Otherwise, how could anything in this world be considered beautiful? So the person, there's a person. He has qualities, characteristics. So here are some of his qualities and characteristics. What I would like to do right now is read some from in the 10th canto 3. I'm going to read a whole pastime. I might have to do it quite quickly though. This is when Narada Muni entered Dwarka. Because Narada Muni, this is in chapter 69. Narada Muni had heard that Krishna had married 16,108 queens. Now that's conceivable, actually, because anyone theoretically can marry 16,108 wives. Any man, anyway. Because, okay, now I'll marry this one, and then I'll marry this one, and then I'll marry this one, and theoretically at least, one could marry 16,108. Or you could take them all into a group of 16,108 and marry them all at the same time. So either individually or as a group, one could marry them. If one wanted to marry them as a group, excuse me, at the same time, one would have to marry them in a group. And if one wanted to marry them individually, one could do it one after another. But Narada had heard that Krishna had not only married them 16,108 wives at the same time, but he married them individually. Not as a group, but individually in individual ceremonies. And he had expanded himself into 16,108 Krishnas, and they were living in 16,108 palaces. So Narada Muni wanted to see this for himself. So he was, even Narada Muni was amazed. So the verse opens, the chapter opens with six verses at once. Hearing that Lord Krishna had killed Narakasura and had alone married many brides, Narada Muni desired to see the Lord in this situation. He thought, it is quite amazing. So even Narada Muni was amazed by this, that in a single body, Krishna, Lord Krishna, simultaneously, in one body, simultaneously, at the same time, married 16,000 women, each in a separate palace. Simultaneously, one body, each in their own palace. So how is that possible? So he was amazed by this. So thus the sage of the demigods eagerly went to Dwarka. Now this is what he saw. The city was filled with the sounds of birds and bees flying about the parks and pleasure gardens, while its lakes, crowded with blooming Indavara, Amboja, Karlara, Kumuda, and Utpala lotuses, resounded with the calls of swans and cranes. Dwarka boasted 900,000 royal palaces, all constructed with silver, crystal and silver, and splendorously decorated with huge emeralds. Inside these palaces, the furnishings were bedecked with gold and jewels. Traffic moved along a well-laid-out system of boulevards, roads, intersections, and marketplaces, and many assembly houses and temples of demigods graced the charming city. The roads, courtyards, commercial streets, and residential patios were all sprinkled with water and shaded from the sun's heat by banners waving from flagpoles. In the city of Dwarka was a beautiful private quarter worshipped by the planetary rulers. This district, where the demigod Vishwakarma had shown all his divine skill, was the residential area of Lord Hari. And thus it was gorgeously decorated by the 16,000 palaces of Lord Krishna's queens. Narada Muni entered one of these immense palaces. There were so many palaces, and he picked one and entered. Supporting the palace were coral pillars decoratively inlaid with Vaidurja gems. Sapphires, what color are sapphires? There are yellow sapphires and blue sapphires, actually, both. Prabhupada, there's a picture of Prabhupada in Vrindavan, and he's wearing a yellow sapphire. Sapphires bedecked the walls, and the floors glowed with perpetual brilliance. In that place, palace, Twasta had arranged canopies with hanging strands of pearls. There were also seats and beds fashioned of ivory and precious jewels. In attendance were many well-dressed maidservants bearing lockets on their necks, and also armor-clad guards with turbans, fine uniforms, and jeweled earrings. The glow of numerous jewel-studded lamps dispelled all darkness in the palace. My dear king, on the ornate ridges of the roof danced loudly crying peacocks, who saw the fragrant agaru incense escaping through the holes of the latticed windows and mistook it for a cloud. In that palace, the learned Brahmana, Narada Muni, saw the lord of the Satvitas of the Yadurishi dynasty, together Sri Krishna, together with his wife, who fanned him with a gold-handled Yaktel Fan. She personally served him in this way, even though she was constantly attended by 1,000 maidservants equal to her in personal character, beauty, youth, and fine dress. The Supreme Lord is the greatest upholder of religious principles. Thus, when he noticed Narada, he rose at once from the goddess Sri's bed, from the goddess of fortune's bed. He bowed his crowned head at Narada's feet, and joining his palms, he had the sage sit in his own seat. The Lord bathed Narada's feet and then put the water on his own head. Although Lord Krishna is the supreme spiritual authority of the universe and the master of his devotees, it was proper for him to behave in that way, for his name is Brahmanyadeva, the Lord who favors the Brahmanas. Thus Sri Krishna honored the sage Narada by bathing his feet, even though the water that bathes the Lord's feet, own feet, becomes the Ganges, the ultimate holy shrine. After fully worshipping the great sage of the demigods according to Vedic injunctions, Lord Krishna, who is himself the original sage, Narayan, the friend of Nara, conversed with Narada, and the Lord's measured speech was as sweet as nectar. Finally, the Lord asked Narada, "What may we do for you, our Lord?" And Sri Narada said, "O almighty Lord, it is no surprise that you, the ruler of the world, show friendship for all people and yet subdue the envious. As we well know," so Narada knew Krishna's glories very well, that he was the Lord, even though he was in this palace. "You descend by your sweet will in order to bestow the highest good on this universe by maintaining and protecting it. Thus your glories are widely known. Now I have seen your feet, which grant liberation to your devotees, which even Lord Brahma and other great personalities of unfathomable intelligence can only meditate upon within their hearts, and which those who have fallen into the well of material existence resort to for deliverance. Now I have seen your feet. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Please favor me so that I may constantly think of you as I travel about. Please grant me the power to remember you." That's actually what Dhruva Maharaj asked from Kuvera also. This is actually the benediction that the devotees want more than anything else. "Please allow my mind to be fully focused." Narada then entered the palace of another of Lord Krishna's wives. He was eager to witness the spiritual potency possessed by the master of all mystic powers. There, in the next palace, he saw the Lord playing at dice with his beloved consort and his friend Uddhav. Lord Krishna worshipped Narada by standing up, offering him a seat, and so on, and then, as if he did not know, asked him, "When did you arrive? What can needy persons like us do for you, for those who are full in themselves? In any case, my dear Brahmana, please make my life auspicious," thus addressed. Narada was astonished. He simply stood up silently and went to another palace. This time Naradaji saw that Lord Krishna was engaged as an affectionate father, petting his small children. From there he entered another palace and saw Lord Krishna preparing to take his bath. And in one place, the Lord was offering oblations into the sacrificial fires. In another, worshipping through the 5 Mahajagyas. In another, feeding Brahmins, and yet another, eating the remnants of food left by Brahmins. Somewhere, Lord Krishna was observing the rituals for worship at sunset by refraining from speech and quietly chanting his Gayatri mantra. And elsewhere, he was moving about with sword and shield in the areas set aside for sword practice. In one place, Lord Gadagaraj was riding on horses, elephants and chariots. In another place, he was resting on his bed while bards, poets, recited his glories. Somewhere, he was consulting with royal ministers like Uddhav. And somewhere else, he was enjoying in the water, surrounded by many society girls and other young women. Somewhere, he was giving well-decorated cows to exalted brahmanas. And elsewhere, he was listening to the auspicious narration of epic histories and puranas. Somewhere Lord Krishna was found enjoying the company of a particular wife by exchanging joking words with her. Somewhere else he was found engaged along with his wife in religious ritualistic functions. Somewhere Krishna was found engaged in matters of economic development. And somewhere else he was found enjoying family members according to the regulative principles. Somewhere he was sitting alone, meditating on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is transcendental to material nature. And somewhere he was rendering menial service to his elders, offering them desirable things and reverential worship. In one place he was planning battles in consultation with some of his advisors, and in another place he was making peace. Somewhere Lord Keshava and Lord Balaram were together pondering the welfare of the pious. Narada saw Lord Krishna engaged in getting his sons and daughters married to suitable brides and bridegrooms at the appropriate time, and the marriage ceremonies were being performed with great pomp. Narada observed how Sri Krishna, the master of all yoga masters, arranged to send away his daughters and son-in-laws, and also to receive them home again at the time of great holiday celebrations. All the citizens were astonished to see these celebrations. Somewhere he was worshipping all the demigods with elaborate sacrifices. Elsewhere he was fulfilling his religious obligations by doing public welfare work, such as the construction of wells, public parks, and monasteries. In another place he was on a hunting expedition, mounted on his Sindhi horse, and accompanied by the most heroic of the Yadus, he was killing animals meant to be offered in sacrifice. But Narada he was amazed by all this, but nothing really made him laugh or shocked him until the next thing that he saw. Somewhere, Krishna, the Lord of mystic powers, was moving about in disguise amongst the homes of ministers and other citizens in order to understand what each of them was thinking. Having thus seen this display of the Lord's yoga maya, Narada mildly laughed. That one he thought was really amazing. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, Narada fully understood the Lord's omniscience, and thus when he saw the Lord trying to find out the mood of his ministers, moving about in disguise, Narada could not help but laughing. But remembering the Lord's supreme position, he somewhat constrained his laughter. And then, after seeing all this, Narada Muni addressed Rishikesh, who was adopting the behavior of a human being. Narada said, "Now we understand your mystic potencies, which are difficult to comprehend, even for great mystics. O Supreme Soul, O Master of all mystic powers, only by serving your feet have I been able to perceive your powers. O Lord, please give me your leave. I will wander about the worlds which are flooded with your fame, loudly singing about your pastimes which purify the universe." Because Narada had asked him, "What do you want?" The Lord had said to Narada, "Why have you come? What do you want?" And Narada said, "I want to always remember you." So Krishna gave him so many things to remember. So much content, because remembrance needs content. So Krishna gave him so much content for his remembrance, to fulfill Narada's desire. And Narada's reaction again was, "Oh, I will just wander around the world just singing your glories. By your grace, I've been able to see how powerful you actually are and how amazing you are, even disguised. You're wandering around even though you're omniscient. So you are so amazing." So then the Lord spoke to him, to Narada, "O Brahmana, I am the speaker of religion, its performer and sanctioner. I observe religious principles to teach them to the world, my child. So do not be disturbed." Sukadeva Goswami said, Thus, in every palace, Narada saw the Lord in his same personal form, executing the transcendental principles of religion that purify those engaged in household affairs. Having repeatedly seen the vast mystic display of Lord Krishna, whose power is unlimited, the sage was amazed and filled wonder. Lord Krishna greatly honored Narada, faithfully presenting him with gifts related to economic prosperity, sense gratification, and religious duties. Thus fully satisfied, the sage departed, constantly remembering the Lord. In this way, Lord Narayan imitated the ways of ordinary humans, manifesting his divine potencies for the benefit of all beings. Thus he enjoyed, dear King Maharaj Prakrit, in the company of his 16,000 exalted consorts, who served the Lord with their shy, affectionate glance. Lord Hari is the ultimate cause of the universal creation, maintenance, and destruction. My dear King, anyone who chants about, hears about, or simply appreciates the extraordinary activities he performs, Krishna performs in this world, which are impossible to imitate, will surely develop devotion for the Supreme Lord, the bestower of liberation. Make sure we all got that benediction. The Shruti Phal. So this was what was going on in each and every one of these palaces. And Krishna had been away. And now he entered. He himself personally entered each one of those 16,108 palaces upon his return from Hastinapur after the Battle of Kurukshetra had been completed. Now, how did the queens react when they saw him? Text 31. The queens of the Lord rejoiced. So Krishna entered the palace. Within the queens of Lord Sri Krishna rejoiced within their minds to see their husband home after a long period abroad. The queens got up at once from their seats and meditations, and Prabhupada will explain in the purport that they were simply meditating upon Krishna. As was socially customary, they covered their faces shyly and looked about coyly. So this is ultimately what it means that God is great. He is all attractive. So we read some of this purport a little further down. Prabhupada explains, the queens of the Lord were all in meditation, thinking of the Lord's absence, and were always meditating upon him. The Lord's devotees cannot live for a moment without meditating on the Lord. And what to speak of the queens, who are all goddesses of fortune, incarnated as queens in the pastimes of the Lord at Dwarka. They can never be separated from the Lord, either by presence or by trance. The gopis at Vrindavan could not forget the Lord when the Lord was away in the forest cowherding. When the Lord boy, Krishna, was absent from the village, so he was doing something here in Dwarka that was so incredible, it was inimitable. No one can do that, obviously, being 16,108 places at the same time, performing different pastimes with each and every one of them. It wasn't 16,108 mirrors that will all have to do the same thing that the original person is doing. No, each one of those were acting individually. So we have to accept, if we accept that it happened, we have to accept this is God, and this is what it means that God is great. But yet this same God does something more wonderful in Vrindavan, when without any of these opulences, he takes off his royal shoes and wanders around the forests, leaving his lotus footprints there. And the residents of Vrindavan just loved him in a way that no one else can love him. The gopis, when the Lord boy Krishna was absent, so we have to keep all that this is the Krishna who is capable of that. Not only is he capable of the universes, but he can manifest all these palaces and unlimited opulences and billions of queens. But look what he chooses to do more than anything else is wander around Vrindavan. So when the Lord boy Krishna was absent from the village, the gopis at home used to worry about him traversing the rough ground with his soft lotus feet. By thinking thus, they were sometimes overwhelmed in trance and mortified in the heart. Such is the condition of the pure associates of the Lord. They're always in trance, and so the queens were in trance during the absence of the Lord. Presently, having seen the Lord from a distance, they at once gave up all their engagements, including the vows of women as described above. According to Sri Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, there was a regular psychological reaction on the occasion. First of all, rising from their seats, Krishna entered. This is what they did naturally. They rose from their seats, although they wanted to see their husbands. They were deterred because of feminine shyness. But due to strong ecstasy, they overcame that stage of weakness and became caught up with the idea of embracing the Lord. And this thought factually made them unconscious of their surrounding environment. This prime state of ecstasy annihilated all other formalities and social conventions, and thus they escaped all stumbling blocks on the path of meeting the Lord. And that is the perfect stage of meeting the Lord of the soul. 32. The insuperable ecstasy was so strong that the queens, who were shy, first embraced the Lord in the innermost recesses of their hearts. Then they embraced him visually. And then they sent their sons to embrace him, which is equal to personal embracing. But, O chief amongst the Bhrigus, though they tried to restrain their feelings, they inadvertently shed tears. Although Lord Sri Krishna was constantly by their sides, as well as exclusively alone, his feet appeared to them to be newer and newer. The goddess of fortune, although by nature always restless and moving, could not quit the Lord's feet. So what woman can be detached from those feet, having once taken shelter of them? So we've actually heard how Krishna entered the palaces of those queens very, very, very touchingly. And then they could never leave his lotus feet. How could anyone be detached from those feet, having once... Now there's some resume and summing up till the end of this chapter, which ends it on 39. There's some speaking about Krishna, and Sutta will describe some of the philosophy, and Prabhupada's purports here are very important, and we'll just read some excerpts. The Lord was pacified after killing those kings who were burdensome to the earth. So his mission actually was finished. Kurukshetra was over. They were puffed up with their military strength, their horses, elephants, chariots, infantry, etc. He himself was not a party in the fight. He simply created hostility between the powerful administrators, and they fought amongst themselves. He was like the wind which causes friction between bamboos and sows sparks of fire. So we've discussed that point already. Prabhupada's purport is quite important, but we've discussed how Krishna dealt with this. He didn't himself kill anyone. He just witnessed, just was a neutral chariot driver. But yet, by his desire, it all happened. That the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, out of his causeless mercy, appeared on this planet by his internal potency and enjoyed himself amongst competent women, That the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, out of his causeless mercy, appeared on this planet by his internal potency and enjoyed himself amongst competent women as if he were... That Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, out of his causeless mercy, appeared on this planet by his internal potency. That Supreme Lord, who appeared by an internal potency, enjoyed himself amongst competent women as if he were engaged in mundane affairs.
We'll read the beginning of Prabhupada's purport here. The Lord married and lived like a householder. This is certainly like a mundane affair. But when we learn that he married 16,108 wives and lived with them separately in each and every palace, certainly it is not mundane. Therefore, the Lord, living as a householder amongst his competent wives, is never mundane, and his behavior with them is never to be understood as mundane sex relation. The women who became the wives of the Lord are certainly not ordinary women, because to get the Lord as one's husband is the result of many, many millions of births tapasya, austerity. When the Lord appears on different lokas or planets, or on this planet of human beings, he displays his transcendental pastimes just to attract the conditioned souls to become his eternal servitors, friends, parents, and lovers, respectively, in the transcendental world, where the Lord eternally reciprocates such exchanges of service. So here is something that we have to learn right from the very beginning of the Bhagavatam, is that there is no material tinge in anything that Krishna does. There is nothing selfish. If we try to superimpose our consciousness on the person who is doing this, we'll think, well, if I was doing something like this, then I would be trying to enjoy in this way, in this way, in that way. So how could Krishna be God? But that is anthropomorphic. Creating God in man's image. But how can we understand his consciousness? We are tiny and finite. So it is foolish to think like that. So that's the first point. And why does Krishna come then? If he doesn't come just to enjoy himself, as I would like to enjoy myself, why does he come? So that question is answered. To show pastimes that are so attractive, the conditioned souls become attracted to have a relationship with Krishna and will relate with him eternally in the spiritual. But it goes on. But we should always keep that in mind. Although the queen's beautiful smiles, we'll read from here until the end and then we'll read some purports. Although the queen's beautiful smiles and furtive glances were all spotless and exciting, and although they could conquer Cupid himself by making him give up his bow in frustration, and although even the tolerant Shiva could fall victim to them, still, despite all their magical feats and attractions, they could not agitate the senses of the Lord. So there is no question of the actions of Cupid. Nothing mundane in these dealings. The queens were acting with every feminine trick to capture his mind. And he appeared to go under their control in so many ways. And no one could resist them. But yet Krishna was not the slightest bit agitated, because there is no calm. There is no come at all within Krishna, because there is no lack, there is no need. So there is no lust. He's the supreme Atmaram. So even little Atmarams, self-satisfied souls, become so attracted to hear about the supreme Atmarama. So then the next question comes. So he's come, Krishna has come to demonstrate his pastimes to attract everyone. And his motive, the driving force that motivates him is not lust. So what is it? What is pushing Krishna to do these things? So we'll read from Prabhupada's purport after. I said after. The common materialistic conditioned souls speculate that the Lord is one of them. So remember, this is in the first canto, and it's a glimpse that everyone who's reading the Bhagavatam is getting a very, very intimate dealings. So Sutta is giving a purport to these dealings right in the verses. He's explaining them so that they're not mistaken by the readers. They're not. Krishna wasn't at all agitated. The common materialistic conditioned soul speculate that the Lord is one of them. Out of their ignorance, they think the Lord is affected by matter, although he is unattached. This is the divinity of the personality of Godhead. He is not affected by the qualities of material nature. When he's the creator of material nature, by definition, he is not affected by the qualities because he's existing before them. He creates them. Or when he comes as Lord Varaha or Lord Nrisingadev, Lord Nrisingadev is so angry, but it's not anger that like we have anger. And Varaha Dev is not a hog in any way, because the Brahmins who are watching Varaha Dev are worshipping him. No Brahmins who are the emblem of cleanliness and purity will worship a hog. Their conclusion is that he is Jagya, and all the sacrifices of the Vedas are meant to please him. And when he comes as Vamandev, he expands his lotus foot so it pierces the universe. He's never in the material world, although a mental person trying to figure out what God is with his own power will certainly misunderstand everything. So he's not affected. This is the divinity of the personality of Godhead. Otherwise, you turn into an impersonalist. Because we're thinking, well, this quality is material and this quality is material, so therefore he can't have any qualities. And that way he is safe from being material and he's a transcendent Lord. But Krishna has qualities, but they're all transcendental just by the fact that he's doing it by definition. So he is not affected by the qualities of material nature, even though he is in contact with them. Similarly, the devotees who have taken shelter of the Lord do not become influenced by material qualities because they're in his shelter. They are not touched by darkness because they are bathed in the light. Their consciousness is bathed in Krishna consciousness. Krishna bhakti rasato bhavato mati. So talking about these women, and this is the simple and delicate women truly thought that Lord Sri Krishna, their beloved husband, followed them and was dominated by them. Like every woman, they were unaware of the extent of the glories of their husband, as the atheists are unaware of him as the supreme controller. So amazingly, this chapter ends on an amazing note. It may not sound amazing to us because we're very familiar with this thought, but it is amazing that the materialists, the atheists, atheist, materialist means atheist, we could say. They're forgetting Krishna as God, and they're seeing him as ordinary, and they're seeing his activities as ordinary because of the influence of Maya. But the queens completely become unaware of the extent of God's powers, amazingly similar to the way that materialists think. But it's completely different. Their forgetfulness is done by Krishna's internal energy. And it causes the Lord ecstasy. And it causes them ecstasy. While the materialist, in their forgetfulness, they're covered here by the material energy. And here, being covered by the spiritual energy, there is the highest ecstasy. And the other is enmity comes about. So that's how Sutta describes his purport and just what happened. And it ends in this wonderful way, that they become unaware of the extent of his glories, as the atheists are unaware of him, a comparison. But yet there is a gulf, a world of difference, And the world is the spiritual world as compared to the material.
Text 36. The question is asked, so why does Krishna deal in the material world or in the spiritual? What motivates him? What pushes him to act in this way? If it's not lust, it's not a lack, it's not a desire on his part, but what is pushing him?
So the first part of the purport describes very much that it doesn't have anything to do with Cupid or material desire. And then Prabhupada describes the attractiveness of the queens, although they could not attract or disturb or agitate his senses. This is because the Lord is the all-perfect Atmaram, or self-sufficient. He does not require anyone's extraneous help for his personal satisfaction. Therefore, the queens could not satisfy the Lord by their feminine attractiveness, but they satisfied him by their sincere affection and service. Only by unalloyed transcendental loving service could they satisfy the Lord, and the Lord was pleased to treat them as wives in reciprocation. So all these pastimes take place because the devotees have specific desires and specific ways that they want to serve Krishna. And Krishna organizes everything to simply reciprocate with his devotees' loving desires for service. They want to serve him as a wife for his pleasure, so Krishna acts towards them as their husband. And this is, in one sense, the secret, the philosophical secret for understanding what is going on in all pastimes. Krishna, his desire is simply to bring transcendental happiness to the devotees. And the devotees simultaneously, their single pointed desire is to bring transcendental happiness to Krishna. So this is what's going on in the spiritual world. So God is not that tyrant who has unlimited servitors and he's forcing everyone into servitorship and having him bring him things all day long. That's basically what Hiranyakashipu is doing in a somewhat limited way in the material world. But Krishna, rather, the opposite. He becomes the servant of those who give themselves to him fully. Bhakti vatsalya atma parjantabad. Otherwise, he would be a transcendental tyrant. This quality of bhakti vatsal makes him the most lovable, all-worshipable Supreme Personality. So only by unalloyed transcendental loving service could they satisfy the Lord, and the Lord was pleased to treat them as wives in reciprocation. Thus, being satisfied by their unalloyed service only, the Lord reciprocated the service just like a devout husband. Otherwise, he had no business becoming the husband of so many wives. He is the husband of everyone, but to one who accepts him as such, he reciprocates. This unalloyed affection for the Lord is never to be compared to mundane lust. It is purely transcendental. And the grave dealings which the queens displayed in natural feminine ways were also transcendental, because the feelings were expressed out of transcendental ecstasy. Everything is done on the level of transcendental ecstasy, born out of transcendental love. It is already explained in the previous verse that the Lord appeared like a mundane husband, but factually his relation with his wife was transcendental, pure, and unconditioned by the motor. So there's no Maya at all involved in Krishna's dealings. Neither the Lord nor the devotees, neither the Lord nor the queens, neither the Lord nor the residents of Vrindavan are affected in any way by the modes of material nature. I'd like to read the purport of 38. One may argue that his relation with the goddess of fortune, this is a little bit down, may be transcendental. But what about his relation with the Yadu dynasty, being born in that family, or his killing the non-believers like Jarasandha and other asuras, directly in contact with the modes of material nature? The answer is that the divinity of the supreme of the personality of Godhead is never in contact with the qualities of material nature in any circumstances. Actually, he is in contact with such qualities because he is the ultimate source of everything. Yet, he is above the actions of such qualities. He is known, therefore, as Yogeshwar, or the master of mystic power, or in other words, the all-powerful. Even his learned devotees are not affected by the influence of the material modes. The great six Goswamis of Vrindavan all came from greatly rich and aristocratic families, but when they adopted the life of mendicants at Vrindavan, superficially they appeared to be in a wretched condition of life, but factually they were the richest of all in spiritual values. Raghunath Das Goswami is very lean and thin, and he's sitting at the bank of Radhakund and crying and crying and crying, and some mundane person looking at him may think, well, of course he's crying. He's so lean and thin, he must be so hungry. Anyway, if I was hungry like that, I'd be crying too. So why doesn't he just go home to his wealthy father, the Jamindar in Bengal? But no, Raghunath Das Goswami was very happy at Akund because he was relishing the deepest, the greatest of wealths. So the richest of all in spiritual values. Such Mahabhagavatas, or first-grade devotees, although moving amongst men, are not contaminated by honor or insult, hunger or satisfaction, sleep or wakefulness, which are all resultant actions of the three modes of material nature. Similarly, some of them are engaged in worldly dealings, yet are unaffected. Unless these neutralities of life are there, one cannot be considered situated in transcendence. The divinity and his associates are in the same transcendental plane, and their glories are always sanctified by the actions of Yogamaya, or the internal potency of the Lord. Sanctified, they are in touch. All the activities of these exalted devotees are under the shelter of Yogamaya, the internal energy. The devotees of the Lord are always transcendental, even if they are sometimes found to have fallen in their behavior. The Lord emphatically declares in the Bhagavad Gita 9:30 that even if an unalloyed devotee is found to be fallen due to a previous material contamination, he is nevertheless to be accepted as fully transcendental because of his being engaged 100% in the devotional service of the Lord. The Lord protects him always because of his rendering service unto him, and the fallen conditions are to be considered accidental and temporary. They will vanish in no time. And Prabhupada's purport to the last verse in the chapter, how the unawareness of the queens. Even the transcendental wives of Lord Sri Krishna did not know completely the unfathomable glories of the Lord. This ignorance is not mundane, because there is some action of the internal potency of the Lord in the exchange of feelings between him and his eternal associates. The Lord exchanges transcendental relations in five ways: as master, proprietor, friend, son, and lover. And in each of these pastimes, he plays fully by the potency of Yogamaya, the internal potency. He plays exactly like an equal friend with the cowherd boys, or even with friends like Arjuna. He plays exactly like a son in the presence of Yasoda Mata. He plays exactly like a lover in the presence of the cowherd damsels. And he plays exactly like a husband in the presence of the queens of Dwarka. Such devotees of the Lord never think of the Lord as supreme, but think of him exactly as a common friend, a pet son or a lover, a husband very much dear to his heart and soul. That is the relation between the Lord and his transcendental devotees who act as his associates in the spiritual sky with their innumerable Vaikuntha planets. When the Lord descends, He does so along with his entourage to display a complete picture of the transcendental world, where pure love and devotion for the Lord prevail without any mundane tinge or lording it over the creation of the Lord. Such devotees of the Lord are all liberated souls, perfect representations of the marginal or internal potency in complete negation of the influence of the external potency. The wives of Lord Krishna were made to forget the immeasurable glories of the Lord by the internal potency, so that there may not be any floor of exchange, and they took it for granted that the Lord was a henpecked husband, always following them in lonely places. In other words, even the personal associates of the Lord do not know him perfectly well. So what do the thesis writers or mental speculators know about the transcendental glories of the Lord? The mental speculators present different theses as to his becoming the cause of the creation, the ingredients of the creation, or the material and efficient causes of the creation, etc. But all this is but partial knowledge about the Lord. Factually, they're as ignorant as the common man. The Lord can be known by the mercy of the Lord only, and by no other means. But since the dealings of the Lord with his wives are based on pure transcendental love and devotion, the wives are all on the transcendental plane without material contamination. So that transcendental plane is one that we should all try and board. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the first canto, 11th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Lord Krishna's Entrance into Hare Krishna. Comments, questions? No. Yes, there's expansions of Krishna. That's the Shakti Tattva. Those are most the residents of Vrindavan, the major associates of Krishna that we know. Then there's the internal potency of the Lord. The Prabhupada referred to it as Yogamaya, or the Antaranga Shakti, or the Ladini Sambit. Like that. And then there is the external energy of the Lord, Krishna's Maya Shakti. And then there is Tatastha Shakti, Chetragya Kya Tatapra. Now we are spiritual, but we have to take shelter either the Maya Shakti, because we are so tiny, on one side, or the Antaranga Shakti, the Yoga Maya Shakti, Ladini Samvit Shakti on the other side. We ourselves don't have any ability to give Krishna pleasure because we're small. But when we take shelter of that potency, which is different from the Shakti Tattva that the queens are, for example, then we have, by the mercy of that potency, we have the ability to give Krishna pleasure, because that potency is Krishna's Ladini Shakti, his pleasure-giving potency. And the totality of that, or the sum of that potency, is Srimati Radharani. So ultimately, that taking shelter of that is considered taking shelter of either Lord Balaram or Srimati Radharani. But we know, but we've been given instructions through the chain of the disciplic succession how to please Krishna. And that will also purify us. It's not like first I'll get purified, and then after I'm completely purified, then I'll take up that. No. Because the things that we do, there's two sides to it. One is we don't do certain things, and the other side is the things that we do. So we chant Krishna's names under order. So it may not be completely purely that we're chanting, but because of the mercy of Guru and Guru Parampara, Krishna nevertheless accepts it, and it gives him pleasure, and we are purified. We go see Radhashyama Sunda Krishna Balaram Gonatai, so we're not allowed to bring them anything for their pleasure on Janmashtami. First we have to become completely purified. No, how will we become purified? When we Ya idam paramam guyam mad bhakteshu vidasyati, Krishna says that we should preach. No one will be more dear to me than he who explains the Bhagavad Gita. So, Is that pleasing to Krishna? So we try to do it in such a way, purely, not selfishly, not so I gain fame and respect, but do it in such a way that will be pleasing for Krishna. But we won't be able to do it purely at first. But unless we make our impure attempts, how will we ever be able to do it purely? Like in, before you can, when you were a baby, you tried to speak. So did you first speak perfect German? No. Before you can speak perfect, right, correctly, you have to speak improperly, imperfectly. So therefore, the quality that we should have that will make up this balance is humility. So if we know our impurities, then our offerings are made with humility. Okay, this is the best I can do right now, but please accept this by your grace, not due to the wonder of this offering, but please accept it by your causeless mercy, because I've heard that you are so causelessly merciful. And therefore, and who am I? By the mercy of my Guru Maharaj and the disciplic succession, by the mercy of Prabhupada, I'm able to make this offering. So please know that I'm attempting to be their servant, even though I'm not a very good servant. But please, they are so pure. So please accept this offering because of my connection with them. I'm offering it to you through them. Like that. If we walk up and say, here I am, Krishna, to make an offering to you. Sometimes we're like that. Any other questions or comments? Yes, ma'am. He was. But he's a player that's completely involved in this drama. He becomes... Remember, this is also in the first canto. So it should be explained in that way, also in the first canto. But he's later on, he becomes completely controlled by the... Krishna's consciousness is very hard to understand. Remember that. Because we have a concept, he should be controlled by the devotees. But yet, the whole universe is still coming from him and everything. So we have to put these two together. He's Savagya and Mugdata. So he has these qualities simultaneously. And we out of wishing to come to that stage, want to see only that side. But yet, Krishna's consciousness is unfathomable for us. So we have to accept all the different parts and we can't expect all the different parts to always be explained at the same time, because they're explained in this way at this time because this is what we need to hear at this time. So we accept that and learn the point that's being made. We can never understand Krishna's consciousness. And even when he's acting like a player, if he's acting like a player, so we're thinking, what that means is that he's detached and not really emotionally involved like that. He's just an act. Yes. But when Krishna acts like a player, it's not like that. Say that again. What did I say? But our logic here won't apply to Krishna in the same way. Because it just doesn't work like that. If he's a player, like if a person is in a drama and he's playing the part of Napoleon, of course, and if he starts getting so much involved in the drama that he forgets himself, then maybe he'll have to be taken to the hospital later. But when Krishna, so you could say an actor will be, most actors will be detached. But when Krishna acts as a player and is detached, it's not the same. Because his consciousness is unfathomable to us. That's the second point. The first point is
that this is how it's explained here, because it's the first canto of the Bhagavatam. When Srila Rupa Goswami is explaining something very, or Krishnadas Kaviraj is explaining something very intimate for intimate devotees who are already very, very, very advanced, he won't explain the philosophy in the same way. But we have to always be reminded that it has nothing to do with of how I would be in that circumstance. How, if I was acting as a player, that means such and such. So therefore, if Krishna is acting, it means such and such. Does that apply to how you're thinking, or not so much? To your question, or not so much? No, I didn't get that when I read it. I didn't get that impression. That he was reciprocal, they weren't acting mundane, but the mundane world really, in fact, is modeled on their behavior, in fact. It's a reflection of their behavior. So he's not they're acting purely as wives, and this is how they want to serve him. And he, being Krishna, is reciprocating with them. But that doesn't imply detachment. Although one could say that ultimately he's the Supreme Lord, but it doesn't actually imply detachment. Does that speak to your question or not? Because, for instance, if they're reciprocating, they want him to be attached, so he's acting attached. So he is attached. He's attached to his devotees. He becomes angry at Bhishma Dev when Bhishma Dev's trying to kill Arjuna. But yet, he's the Supreme Lord. And if he knows everything, he knows that Bhishma Dev is going to surrender. But he's angry. And Arjuna's trying to stop him to keep his promise. So is he detached? But if we start thinking that he's angry, and I know how it is to be angry, then we're not understanding Krishna. He's not motivated by the same things that motivate my anger. So we can't actually understand Krishna's consciousness. So when we see contradictions like that, it seems that it's because we're trying too much of our own intelligence. Where it's not ready to go. But yet we want to get a glimpse of it, so it has to be explained from this side and from this side and this side. I may not be able to explain more than this. Yes, and he was acting like that, but he has different energies and he calls on different, at different times. He is detached too. He left the rasa dance. He went to Dwarka. He wasn't so attached that he's stayed with him. He went to Hastinapur. He went to the battle of Kurukshetra. That's what he wants to do. But when it's time for him to be attached to them, he's fully attached to them. But he's Krishna. That's what he wants. And we can't estimate what his consciousness is like. And what is this? You have two choices here. You can ask Narada Muni. Why? Again, he can do what he wants. He's setting the example of a Vedic householder. I can't say more than that. There may have been a comment there that I didn't note. It's in the Vedas. We can't say it's not... We can't say it's not good. Why would it be in the Vedas if it was not good? But it has its particular place and way it's done, so it remains good. When it's done in an improper way, it's not good. We read how when certain animals are sacrificed and their old bodies are turned into new bodies. So is that not good? So we accept that by definition, everything that Krishna does is all good. And we may not be able to understand it, but that's how we start. And that's what's being explained to us.
because the demigods are part of Krishna, the universal form of Krishna. They're part of his body in that sense, and the Vedic sacrifices that worship the demigods always also worship him. And he's setting the example for Vedic householders how to live a perfect life. But if one is a devotee, he doesn't have to live in that kind of way. Yet Bharat Maharaj, when he was the king, he performed Vedic sacrifices, but he did it in the right consciousness. He's showing how to live in the Vedic culture perfectly. Is that okay? Or maybe we think Krishna shouldn't do that? He should just chant Hare Krishna. Sometimes I'm possibly not able to explain these simple points properly. But this is the last question because it's already late. Yes. Yes. So what's so special about Krishna doing that, you're saying? That's what Narada Muni. But when he saw that Krishna had... You saw what happened to Chitraketa's wives. When one of them had a child, the others became envious because he was spending all his time with that one and not them. But Krishna, that didn't happen because he was spending his time with each and every one of them, each in their own palace. All satisfied because Krishna was expanding, or he himself was with each and every one of them. So that's what Narada was astounded. Because one could theoretically marry 10 million wives or 100 million wives, just one after another, all in a big group. But not all at the same time and be with each. Huh? You probably wouldn't live a long time. Take out the garbage! Hare Krishna. Okay, when things like that start going on, it's clearly the end of class. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Sri Krishna ki jai, Krishna's Dwarka Leela ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.